Welcome back. I'm Jaquaya Wilson, and in this episode of The Unlearning of Child Welfare, we continue the conversation from episode 3, where we discuss the how behind building a family well-being approach. As a refresher, I'm joined by Sandra Gonzalez, Matt Anderson, Bobby Taylor, Ned Breslin, Suzanne Shore, and a new guest, Claire Anderson, the Senior Policy Fellow at Chapin Hall. So let's go ahead and dive in right where we left off.
You know, I just want to ask you all, what are those challenges and risks and opportunities that you've had? And could you speak to how your initiatives are working with Indigenous communities? And Suzanne, I'd love it if you could go first.
Sure. So I think some of the reasons that this has worked for us is that kind of all the stars were aligned for us, that we had a NAGI First Lady who was willing to push the governor and a governor who had the insight to want to make this a priority. I can't emphasize how important that has been to making sure that this is successful. But then we also had funders and foundation members who really wanted to see that kind of difference and had that vision. We've been the guinea pig, so hopefully other people can point to us and we can be that role model if you need other people to be inspired, whether it be your governor or other foundations. Some of the challenges that we see is making sure that this sticks around long term, even after the next election for governor. You know, there's also always the risk of emotions getting involved when, for instance, we see a horrific story about child deaths and all of a sudden there's a knee-jerk reaction that people say, oh, the pendulum's gone too far towards prevention, but we need to be prepared for that and ready to explain that's a false choice and that prevention is a big tool that needs to stay a part of our box. For us, we need to expand more into businesses, smaller community funders and foundations, and also involve the judicial branch more and more governmental agencies, for instance, Department of Labor. When we go in and see a family is struggling to pay its bills, don't just help them pay the bills, but then make sure that they get on the Department of Labor's radar so that they can get training. And then as far as our Native American communities, that's been an ongoing challenge for us. And a lot of it has to do with needing to build the trust, which we've been working hard to do. It starts with building that trust and understanding. And for those outside of the community, understanding that we need to step back and not be the experts. And I think we've been working hard to do that. And Thriving Families Initiative is really a huge opportunity for us because we're looking to prioritize that expansion into those tribal communities. And again, it's making that investment, the support, building the trust. So hopefully within 1 year, the work that we've done, I'll be able to report back that we've seen even more success.
Yeah, we'll look forward to that. I think you're spot on with trust and understanding of customizing the way communities want to have their own solutions and us not imposing those values that we might hold. And Bobby, I'm curious from your perspective, what you see.
As a challenge, you know, to be quite honest, I see a lot of challenges, but that comes at the foundational level of relationship building. As we see lived experience being included in spaces, I feel like it's kind of drifting towards a trend. There are amazing organizations that really honor that power sharing and really honor that partnership. I just see in a lot of other different spaces, lived experience becomes a check in the box. And I just have to be honest, that's not how it's going to work, right? We really have to be intentional about those relationships that we're building because that's going to set the tone for the solutions that are going to be created. Another thing that I see as kind of a potential barrier is that systems leaders and systems in general really have to unlearn that authoritative role that they have. It's really easy for them to set those agendas and find a lived experience person to plug into that agenda to carry it forward. Or it's another check in the box where they're like, okay, we have lived experience. It doesn't really match our agenda, but we're going to push our agenda anyway. And we're still going to just say like, well, we have lived experience. So we're saying, you know, we can be inclusive. And that's not how it's going to work. When communities and systems are implementing that inclusion space, I can't stress enough how important it is to really center those relationships, meeting people where they're at, making sure they're equitably paid and compensated, understanding that, you know, if a parent has to find a babysitter to contribute to a system's change, there may be a need for, you know, a childcare payment, right? To help them and meet them where they're at. They're being very vulnerable and exposing some of their truths that are not easy to expose. And so we have to honor that. And every other professional in that space is going to be paid to be there. So it's important that we do that for them too. And that's just a small example, but again, I just have to stress the relationship building, because communities with lived experience are just as important as other stakeholders, in which you would spend a lot of time fostering those relationships.
Claire, we want to get you in here. We know your role at Chapin Hall. You get the purview of the whole country, and we'd love to hear your thoughts on challenges, risks, opportunities, just what you're seeing across the country.
Thanks so much, Sandra, and thanks, everybody. I'm just delighted to be here. I'm going to try and tie together a few dots and connect them, because what we are seeing at the national level, Sandra, is this real interest as states have deepened their planning and initial implementation of Family First, a real hunger to figure out, how do I go further upstream into the prevention space? And as thriving families, Safe for Children, a national commitment to well-being movement, is embarking on new dialogue with the states, we've experienced a tremendous appetite for looking for ways to not just change the narrative, to change the perspective, to change the constructs, the relationships, and the ways in which we engage with, serve, and are in service to communities and families. States are looking for evidence plus. I really like that. I wrote that down as you were talking, because I think states really are trying to figure that out. And what I want to use my time to do is to connect that plus what I think one component of a family and child well-being system can be, addresses, Bobby, your statement that families have tight budgets. And when we listen to families about what they need, one of the first things that we hear are resources, concrete resources, fiscal, economic resources. I want to highlight a few studies that are emerging right now that we didn't have even 5 years ago that lead us to think about economic supports for families in ways that I think we have not until now. So as you look at the amount of money, we're spending a lot of money on a set of outcomes. We're spending somewhere in the neighborhood of $30 billion a year across federal and state funding streams to identify and address and treat child maltreatment, mostly, predominantly in an after the fact engagement with families rather than in the prevention space. And as we think about moving money, there are various ways to do that. And I want to highlight a few policies that already exist. It's not everything, but it shows a pathway, I think. So the studies that I'm referencing show that if you provide even modest economic supports to families, you have a pretty significant reduction in child maltreatment and neglect and in engagement in child welfare. And when I say modest, I mean modest. The earned income tax credit for states that have a state level EITC and provide $1,000 is associated with up to a 10% reduction in child protective services involvement for single mother families and with larger families. That's not much in terms of resource movement. And that's a state policy choice to have a local state level EITC program or not. Minimum wage, if the state chooses to increase the minimum wage even by $1 for every dollar a state raises the minimum wage, you get somewhere in the neighborhood of a little less than a 10% reduction in neglect reports. And these are just a couple of examples. States that expanded Medicaid also saw reductions in reports of neglect, particularly, and this is really important, for kids under the age of 6. We have already in place pathways through which states can make policy decisions to resource families in ways that are important and meaningful. These aren't the only pathways. We've got to find other pathways. But the power of this new evidence says that even for very small amounts of money, we can stabilize families and reduce neglect and reduce involvement with child welfare. And I think that is incredibly powerful. So when we, as a practitioner, look for interventions with families, one of the first things that I should pull out of my toolkit is what are the economic supports that are available in my community, in my state, and how do I get them to families? And if there are not as many as I want, how do I advocate for a different, more robust set of economic and concrete supports for families? So I think what we are finding is that it's possible. There are new pathways that we've not thought about in this context that I think that we could and should be. These are also pretty powerful race equity and social justice strategies, given our long-term systematic deprivation of families of color and communities of color when it comes to economic resources.
Talking about a $30 billion
industry,
$30 billion industry, and you're talking about small amounts of money that families need that would provide them with the concrete supports to prevent further exposure to the system. And Ned, I saw your head just shaking like you were in agreement. Yes. And so I want to go to you, like, to react to Claire. Talk to us about challenges and opportunities.
I think a lot of the challenges, you know, a lot of people tend to focus externally, and I think those are all real. I'd actually like to focus internally. I think there's internal challenges to this and maybe some lessons from Tennyson. So first of all, it required a complete overhaul of our board to go here. And I don't think anyone should underestimate the importance of board leadership. If you're going to make a move that fundamentally threatens your historical business model, if you will, you got to have your board behind you. And I have the greatest board I've ever had in my life. I'm so blessed by that. Second thing is, you have to sit back and kind of humble yourself. Tennyson does amazing work, and we are really proud of it. But the fact is that children and family passed through Tennyson are also homeless, incarcerated, unfortunately have died by suicide. And we have to own that because we're part of the problem. We're trying to change the system, but we're also part of the problem. And so we have to have a much deeper sense of humility as we work, to not think that it's everyone else's problem, it's our problem. Third is, we are an organization that has deep racial challenges internally, operating in a racial context and in an oppressive context. And we have to own that as well. And I want to tell you, that is a really important step. 84% of Coloradans are Caucasian, white. Less than 40% of the kids and families who come through Tennyson are that. So that is outrageous. And rewiring is really focused on stopping that as much as anything else. And that means, to Bobby's point, is we have to find ways to invest in organizations that the child welfare sector never invests in, right? We have to invest in community-based organizations that are doing amazing work and are often unseen and unthought of because they have bigger impact than us. We also have to look at ourselves. The children at Tennyson of color are writing a Bill of Rights that is going to be presented to the entire organization in 2 weeks. And it's strong. It's really strong. We also have to deal with microaggressions, and I'll just give you one. You probably notice I'm handsy. I'm passionate. I am rewarded for that. We have staff whose performance reviews tell them that they're too handsy, they're too emotional and all that stuff. So I'm rewarded and they're told to tamp it down. That is outrageous. So we have to clean up our own act and get our act together if we're going to actually champion
it. And Ned, is that because they're people of color and you're a white man?
Yes, absolutely. And so we have to walk into that messiness because we cannot change the system if we can't change ourselves. Last thing real quickly, I think the biggest lesson and challenge of rewiring, and I want to shout out two real amazing people, Megan Vogels and Claire Morrow. Rewiring is this amazingly ambitious program run by literally two people. And what we've had to do as an organization is to stop thinking that every problem requires Tennyson to build a program, build a service, build some sort of thing to solve the problem. We have had to become facilitators that say we are actually, in many cases, the worst option for that solution. And so they have had to go to shift to facilitators and enablers of others and to push the boundaries beyond the traditional, you know, people that the sector invests in. So we just had a meeting recently, a woman from a community-based, a Latinx community-based organization started crying. She said, no one's even seen us before and you've invested in us. And I promise you that nobody from my community is going to become child welfare involved. That's the kind of trust and that's the kind of courage, because organizations like Tennyson, if this, we might not exist. Do we have the courage to go there? And if we don't, stop playing. We are building an organization that is infused with lived experience, that is empowering people that we don't normally see. And we're saying prevention is a job. It's based on not strengthening families. Families are strong. Find their strengths and build on those. Stop thinking of them as a problem. Unleash them in new ways, and we won't see them. And then I'll sell this property. I'll sell it for what it's worth and donate it. Because at the end of the day, you know, you see these pictures on my wall. These are from kids who've been through tennis, and I want a blank wall. I want a blank wall. And that's only going to happen if we change first. It's not everybody else. We have to change.
Wow. Jaquia, you know, I'm never speechless.
I'm very seldom, but Jesus, that just shook me to my core. I am excited that we have had this conversation and this dialogue and on such a good platform. Oh my gosh. Sandra, what do you think?
You know, I'm sitting with a lot of what all of the panelists are saying. Just the word that comes to mind is courage and mm-hmm. humility, like being able to be humble and knowing that you don't know and making sure that you're Ned, I don't know how you said it, but you said just don't play. These lives aren't meant to be played with. Their families are strong. It's us that's the problem. I just think that's all very powerful.
Yeah. Yes. And I think we have talked ourselves out of a job. So
last gig. I do want to just quickly say thank you to all of you for what you've shared. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to the guy who got us all into this, Matt Anderson, for a wrap up.
Yes, thank you. And there is really not much left to be said. I've just been in the background listening, and this made my day, maybe my week, month, and year too. I'm just leaving this conversation really inspired and grateful, not just for the conversation, but for everything that each of you are doing that brought you to this conversation. You're doing really important, courageous work, and you're doing it for the right reasons on behalf of families and communities where you live. So I'm inspired. And so I want to say thank you to Chwe and Sandra for facilitating such a great conversation. It's not easy to do, and you both do it incredibly well. So thank you. And Ned, Suzanne, Bobby, Claire, thanks for bringing your brilliance and wisdom and energy and the sauce and everything you brought today. Can't thank you enough.
If you're speechless after that conversation, you're clearly in good company. Thanks again to Sandra, Matt, Bobby, Suzanne, Claire, and Ned for joining me in this conversation and being a source of inspiration to us all. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. I hope to see you all in episode 5.